My name's Gareth Epton. I'm now in my 10th year working for Crossrail as a community relations policy manager. I was one of the people who helped devise the commitments we gave in Parliament to manage mitigating the impact on local communities, then putting those into our contractual requirements, then holding our contractors to doing those.
Yes.
And I deal with a whole load of other things, including setting up local community liaison groups and running a community investment programme and overseeing what we do across the boroughs. Clearly, one of the challenges that we have in constructing major projects underground in London is trying to mitigate and manage the effects on the public, both present and future. And we touched on some of that earlier. We're going to come on to ask Bob, who has been the lead point of contact for Tower Hamlets throughout the Crossrail process, to come on to look at the specifics of how Crossrail has affected some of the communities in the borough of Tower Hamlets. Jay Carver, who's a Crossrail project archaeologist, talk about some of the specifics about mitigating some of the archaeological issues and some of the results of that. But first I'd like William to come up and talk about some of the issues around the integration with the urban realm, some of which was touched on earlier. William.
Yes, thank you. I'd really like, I guess, to develop some of the themes which we touched on earlier on, and apologies if you found those very, very boring or very, very uninteresting. Anyway, so what I'd really like to talk about is, I think, the relationship between these kind of underground projects and their relationship with the wider urban realm above. But to start with...
I think you've used the...
Touch the white bit.
Touch the white bit. Thank you. To start with, perhaps even the widest context of all, and simply to make the point that, in a way, London's geology, underground London, has been incredibly favourable over the centuries to the formation of the city ever since it was established by the Romans. In the first place, we get a very relatively gentle topography, which has allowed the city to expand without reaching any kind of natural barriers. That gentle topography has also, of course, allowed the establishment of a major airport very close to the bounds of the city. This is the geological lap, and you see the ground. Sorry. No, I'm not getting the wrong way. The fact that you get, obviously, the valley of the Thames, a very wide alluvial valley, which we'll come on to, but the fact that the gravel terraces come very close to the actual course of the river, particularly on the north side, was essential to establishing a city, a port, where it was easy to dock your ships, get them up onto the gravel terrace without having to kind of stomp across acres of mud. So the presence of those gravel terraces, particularly on the north side of the river, where of course the Romans established their first city, has been a very, very important factor to the future of London. And then the orangey deposits here, keeping my finger nice away, the brick earth, which has meant that actually the materials for building London, the very bricks out of which Georgian London is constructed, were the materials for doing that were right on your doorstep, indeed in many cases actually underneath your house. So you dig out the ground beneath your house, make it into the bricks of which you would then construct the house. And then, particular Romans, I guess, I did that sort of underlying blanket of London clay, which is really pretty easy to tunnel through. So it's really enabled the development of the tube system from what the sort of late, mid to late 19th century onwards. The geology and the topography of London, in other words, has been a very, very important factor in allowing the city to develop and expand as a world capital. And it has also enabled London to expand to the particular needs of the time. And the slide at the bottom here simply shows, obviously, the line of the River Thames with its very wide floodplain. And you can see the gravel terraces. I didn't touch it there. The gravel terraces get close to the north side. That's where you get the Roman city. But following then, going on down the river, you can see, first of all, chronologically, St. Catherine's Docks, first mentioned in 1125, the Surrey Docks in the 15th century. Gradually, in time, the docks move down the river. As the ships get bigger, so the docks can move around down the river, and they can make use of that extraordinary kind of alluvial spread of the Bran to get bigger and bigger and bigger. In other words, as ships got bigger, as the technology of trade changed, the particular geological location of London, particularly the wide alluvial plain of the Thames, made it possible for the Port of London to expand continually to meet the requirements of seaborne trade. It's a very interesting question now that seaborne trade is no longer part of the lifeblood of London, whether London has got those kind of right geological landscape conditions to allow the city to continue to flourish in the future. Moving then, abandon pointing the screen, to look at sort of infrastructure and geology slightly more locally, and to develop points, one of the points which was made in the discussion earlier on, is that there is, unless we're very, very careful, a fundamental mismatch between the engineering requirements of transport infrastructure and the urban requirements of transport infrastructure. And what we've done on this slide here is to take it, what was known at the time as High Street 2012. It was when the Olympic Marathon was going to finish off running down towards Stratford. And we did a study on that, a characterisation study. And the big red circles and the names in the red squares, Aldgate, Whitechapel, Mile End, Bow and so forth, they mark the historic settlements, so the concentrations of historic concentrations of population on that very important main road into London from the east. The London Underground symbols show the marked positions of the district line stations as they were put in the late 19th century, I guess. And it's very interesting to see that although they take the names of the historic places, they actually don't respect the locations of those places at all. You can see that they are structured to get a nice regular division between the stops so that you can get the kind of maximum efficiency of the trains moving along. Irrespective of the fact that the station now known as Mile End there is absolutely miles away, almost literally, from the historic location of Mile End. Whitechapel Station, again, midway between the historic Whitechapel and Mile End. Stepney Green, on the site of what was historically Mile End Old Town, actually miles away from a considerable distance away from Stepney Green itself. So I think there is a serious problem here in that if it's just left to the kind of infrastructure engineers to deal with these things, there is a risk that you end up with a transportation system which will work very, very well in kind of railway operational terms, but won't actually be as useful as it could be to the communities living on the surfaces above. We see that here on the district line. You also see it, for example, very clearly on stations like Liverpool Street, for example. The reason why Liverpool Street is kind of basically down in a hole is that when it was built, the railway engineers thought at the time that it was going to be very, very important to have a direct link from the Great Eastern Main Line onto the Metropolitan Line, onto the underground system. It was on that basis that they had to have Liverpool Street down low in order for it to be on the right level to link into what's now the tube system. It never happened, but the result is a station whose relationship with the city around it is very, really very, very unsatisfactory indeed. There's an additional point here, I think, related to how these stations were originally conceived in relation to how they operate today. And again, Liverpool Street and Paddington are two very good examples of this. When Liverpool Street was built, everyone commuting into that station was heading down to the city to the south. There was really nothing to make people come out of Liverpool Street and head to the north. Today, of course, that's completely the opposite. It's the same in Paddington, where the whole Paddington Basin development has transformed the way that people arriving in Paddington want to move around the station in order to come out. And it's proved incredibly difficult at stations like Paddington and Liverpool Street actually to kind of turn these stations round to get them facing in the direction that people need them to face today in order to get out of them in the direction in which they want to go. Touch the screen just one more. Yeah. And finally then, to return to the slide which we saw briefly before, the whole question of what's going to happen at Farringdon Station. Again, Farringdon, a station which when it was built effectively served the meat market in this direction here, but had no particular reason to have any exits and things to serve people who might be living north of the station in the King's Cross area. That position is now completely transformed, and so we're not only getting nearly three times as many people coming out of the station in the morning, probably will be when Crossrail is finished, but also they want to go in directions which simply weren't thought about when that Farringdon station was being laid out in the first place. Well, as those will know, the only exit at the moment is down onto Cowcross Street there. So, to some extent, you can cope with that in the design of the new station by having a new exit. So as you can see, quite a significant number of the new people using Farringdon will be coming out of a new exit at the northern end of the station. But, and this comes back to the point which I tried to make earlier on in the presentation, that the station may be able to deal with all these new people, but what happens when they actually get out into the public realm, when three times as many people are arriving at Farringdon at that time? You come into a grid, a very medieval grid of narrow streets. How can one actually introduce the urban realm improvements which will do as much as possible to make it as easy as possible for people arriving at this station to get to where they need to do? And I hope those are some useful thoughts.
William, thanks very much. I think that sets the scene, for some of the discussions that Crossrail is really having in real time now with a lot of the boroughs, and starting to happen with a lot of the communities as railway starts to become a physical reality for the communities along the route, and people start to think about, well, actually, how are we going to manage these? So relating earlier, we have a series of local liaison panels, and one, I shan't say where, a lady came in who probably wouldn't have passed the strict drugs and alcohol policies that Crossrail operates, and had a long lunch. Don may have been there. And she was very concerned, from a residential area a few hundred yards away from one of the big central Crossrail stations, about all these people. So she wanted, in all seriousness, us to build a wall to keep this new level of footfall away from the residential area. It's not been an argument that's come up many times, certainly not presented in those terms. But there is a real fear of the unknown that's related by some of the communities in terms of what Crossrail will do to change communities, but also what we will do to manage this new flow of people going through those areas. You may want to touch on that a bit later on. Can I now move on to a man who once did, I think, 18 or 20 presentations, appearances on the media in a day, because Jay, as the project archaeologist, was responsible for the item that, to date, has garnered Crossrail the single largest amount of publicity. And Jay, hand over to you to talk about the archaeology, which was that subject.
Thank you very much. Afternoon, everyone. Archaeological finds a huge potential benefit to large projects or projects of any size. But also, as we heard one or two of the panel members upstairs say, initially at the start of a project, they're a threat because the headlines from projects which you could class in the kind of world-class style, like Crossrail, have over the decades been associated with headlines like this and like this and like this. Stumbling delays, causing havoc to construction programs, particularly and cost schedules in terms of redesign, etc. Okay, so archaeology is a threat. These are three slides I put up on my first day at Crossrail when I was asked to give a talk on how I was going to approach the project. And this is almost certainly the most important factor to keep in mind when starting on a construction project somewhere like London, where the archaeology is significant, extensive, hugely diverse in terms of its preservation, depth, and historical background. There has been in the last two or three decades a huge emphasis in the archaeological profession to manage that risk, and we've been through, since 1990 and the introduction of the first piece of planning regulation protecting archaeological remains in the planning process, some very important bits of research and guidance which archaeologists have contributed to this big question of how can we set off on a large project and protect the programme and therefore realise the benefits, because it's really impossible to talk in positive terms about archaeological finds if they're costing hundreds of millions of pounds and delaying the opening of projects. So a number of references there I've just put up in case you're not aware of them. Probably the most important development in terms of how archaeology is now approached as an integrated topic in infrastructure is the SEQUEL scheme and the fact that the historic environment since its revision in 2008 is really thoroughly integrated into all those sustainability and environmental topics in infrastructure design and delivery. There are a number of things we can do to tackle the threat of below ground archaeological remains. And sometimes, in my experience, these are actually overlooked, particularly by archaeologists, funny enough. And there are a lot of cases where cursory understanding of the resource is deemed sufficient for planning, and in some cases, that is the case, but it's not sufficient for a proper integrated planning of a construction programme. So understanding the resource and quantifying that resource fully through very specific interventions in terms of trial pits, in terms of modelling the below ground topography which exists across our historic cities is a massively important area to invest in very early on in the project planning. Even to the extent that it might cost a lot of money. We mentioned a lot about utilities earlier and the fact there's a lot in the way in a city of actually getting to the archaeological layers. Closing roads and knocking holes through the bottom of buildings is an absolutely essential first step, even though very early on in a project people tend to want to shy away from that type of destructive sampling. But approached well does give you a very good idea of what you're going to find. One of our colleagues upstairs mentioned 0.03% as a typical GI coverage, whereas in archaeology we really wouldn't be happy with anything less than 15% in terms of physical investigation of the ground to find out exactly what's there. The other big issue that faces infrastructure projects, in my experience of many of them, is the clarity in the contract requirements and who exactly is being allocated the risk to manage archaeological discoveries, both the known resource that we know we've got to deal with and also the unknown. So where, in terms of the contract allocation, those issues lie with extremely important factor. Integrating the schedule and the critical path is another one. If you're involved in infrastructure, it's very, very important to tackle the archaeologist robustly in terms of exactly what we're going to find, how long is it going to take, and get that information into the main contractors' programs. Time and time again, we come to start a major project, everyone knows there's archaeology, but has the message got through to the people who really should be dealing with it at that stage, and that is the construction schedules, and have they put in that sufficient amount of time? And likewise, has the potential for fines been analysed against the critical path? Archaeology in one place isn't a problem. Right next door, a major problem if it's going to start impacting on finding programmes and hugely expensive equipment, which if delayed runs into 6-7 figures. Communication then is the key, and this is really about the internal communication between archaeological team and those exact people who are going to build the job, the construction managers and the site managers. So a massive emphasis again on really trying to get across to the non-archaeologist what it means for these other activities. Because there's often an assumption that the archaeologist is going to be dealt with by someone, Museum of London perhaps, who'll come in and do it. And in the old days, of course, when we had a state service, that's exactly what happened. And that's why quite often contracts were delayed by months and years while the state service dealt with it. But these days, the archaeology needs to be built in and delivered as part of that delivery team. Public relations and sustainability objectives are all, of course, about realising the benefits. The archaeological benefits are primarily, of course, about publishing new research on a resource which is absolutely finite, and once the construction project destroys it, it's gone. But also the community and educational benefits that come from a well-managed programme are hugely important, as Gareth said, hugely important also in terms of PR to the organisation. The maximum can be gained through this good kind of planning. Just wanted to give a couple of examples. Change, of course, in design is absolutely constant on large programmes. And this is an example of a piece of work that, up until the point the main contractor starts his job and is on site, we've got a certain amount of mitigation work already planned. But this stuff was all new, and this was down to the fact that all of a sudden there wasn't enough room for storing tunnel spoil, in this case, the eastern tunnel site for Crossrail, Limbo Peninsula. And a huge new storage facility was needed, and needed to be built very quickly. It happened to coincide, here you can see in this picture, with the remains of an important historic shipyard in London, the Thames Ironworks. And the huge timbers you see there are the very good survival of the original timber slipways used to launch ships in the 19th century. And that was possible to achieve through very close liaison amongst the construction teams and the archaeological teams, and work to create that slab, as you see in the background, continuing immediately as we're recording the stuff in the foreground. Site access is a big problem for archaeological mitigation, especially in the urban environment where it could be deeply buried. It's not easy to get at. In this case, this is one of the eastern London portals where the archaeological layer of interest is actually 5 metres below the current ground surface. So prior to the type of construction you see there, these big de-walls and dewatering being in place in the River Thames area, very difficult to dig a hole of 5 metres with no dewatering. It'll fill with water immediately. So in this case, the archaeology necessarily thoroughly integrated in the construction programme to take place alongside. And in this case, just to the side of that picture, you can see construction progressing well to the final formation levels. And again, very, very careful control needed to achieve those investigations in very strict time scales. Another issue, late design change. In this case, this is a grout shaft that was additionally required in the Farringdon area for Farringdon East and Ticket Hall and the route of the tunnels. That was realised too late or not. The hole coincided with a graveyard, in this case the Black Death Cemetery at Charterhouse Square. And then again, proposed as a design change, fine. We know there's a cemetery there. We've done sufficient research on the surrounding areas to know exactly what we're going to find. And we can put in sufficient time in the programme to deal with that. Okay, so in terms of stakeholder engagement and the objectives that go into the second half of the programme, realising the benefits, there's a whole range of things, including reuse and recycle of historic materials throughout the job, both those being demolished and those being discovered below ground. So in getting all those historic environment issues into the sustainability strategy, very important. Opportunities for collaboration with educational facilities is there always, and quite often, well, people feel it's a nice to have, but the impact can be extremely large if you've got the willingness to go and set up those collaborations. The local community on a project like Crossrail has benefited in a number of ways from sharing the discoveries we've made with them very openly in terms of events, community digs, talks, many of them, and also an opportunity to involve locals in skill development programmes, which we've done by getting people on a voluntary basis in to really learn about the archaeology and history of their area. Obviously, all the archaeological programme helps the good neighbourly attitude, local residents, they're being shared and hopefully sharing something interesting with them. And then the media opportunities, of course, are large when you've got someone who's willing to put their mind to how we tell the story. So, several examples. I probably haven't got time to go through these, but lots of examples on the Crossroad programme where this combination of well-executed archaeology and a very supportive team in terms of public relations has enabled the full benefits of a number of these areas to be realised. So, just to conclude, several areas where to make archaeology a success on infrastructure projects, we really need to focus on that programme risk. Time and time again, ask those questions of the archaeologist. Have they really investigated sufficiently and quantified what they're going to find? And getting those words in the contract right. And there's a lot of good advice in those publications that I put up earlier to allow us to develop a very robust scheme and realise those full benefits.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I don't know if anyone has any questions specifically on that or on William's presentation, or if we take questions at the end, or if we move on to setting out Crossrail and all of the challenges at Whitechapel.
I was going to ask the Crossrail, have you had any examples of struggling to convince someone that something is archaeology, not just some old stuff?
It's a very valid question. Historical archaeology, which includes industrial remains from the 19th century, it does need some convincing sometimes. And the fact is that archaeologists have started to promote these types of archaeology for the reason they were being lost wholesale, and we were starting to realise actually that our knowledge of those 19th century industries, for example, or the way the early railways were set out, is disappearing fast, and the records aren't kept as well, as we heard earlier, for utilities, as you might expect. Yeah. And so the opportunity for those bits of archaeology is usually fairly rapid. There's not a huge detailed piece of recording needed, but the records we make here in a fairly short time order are very important for that historical legacy, especially where those records have all gone, the millions. So you need to address these issues definitely with our project leaders, and as well if you demonstrate the local value, something like the Thames Ironworks, hugely important to Canning Town. Mm-hmm. It was their major focus, where everyone was employed, and over 100 years have been forgotten. So bringing that back into people's minds gives them a really positive sense of culture history.
Yes, it's a recent archaeology, but I don't think it gets as much respect or even acknowledgement. That's like recent.
Yeah.
A lot of people just look for the date, the older, the more important. So that's not necessarily.
I think that's completely changed in the view of archaeology, especially around the world. That's changed. We're now looking at mid-century buildings for listing, 1950s. Cold War architecture as well, and all these things. We're coming to realise that time goes by, so we shouldn't put a date down as a significance, not a significance.
People might be digging up the foundations of the Shard in the future.
2,000 years' time, quite possibly. Hopefully we can keep some drawings, to be able to access them. Okay.
Anyone else? Well, going back to the first bit, and in fact what you said upstairs, the point about humility and I'd add honesty. These schemes evolve as they go along. When the Channel Tunnel railing was being built, the promoters were trying to persuade Camden to make some concessions on the basis of the southerly approach, even though Camden and Essex knew full well, and are talking to Newham about the eastern approach. And they were still doing this half an hour before Norman Lamont blew their cover in his budget speech. When we had the Crossrail scheme of the 90s is very different to the Crossrail scheme now. When we had the East London Line scheme, which was basically uncontroversial, the Braithwaite viaduct was very poorly handled because the scheme had been approved without desecrating it, but then at the last minute there was a decision taken to change it. And first of all, it promotes mistrust when those sort of things happen. And of course, when they want more, then they're all for, but when they need less, and some of the changes, then you no longer need something. There's an unwillingness to let go. You think if the promoters think they've got something, you know, a right to compulsory purchase something, they don't want to admit that they no longer need it. They want to try and hang on to it so they get a bigger capital receipt to pay for the scheme. And to my mind, that comes under dishonesty. So I'd like to see those things recognised and more openness and more flexibility. And when changes are, and when further discoveries are made that result in the project being changed.
I think that's probably a very good segue into Bob's presentation, because some of the issues that we faced in and around Whitechapel, where we are particularly constrained, and where there was an awful lot of change around about the time I joined Crossrail 10 years ago in terms of the scope of the project, have absolutely had to happen as a result of having to listen to neighbours who really are absolutely living the Crossrail works, in some cases pretty much 24/7. So I think, Bob, over to you if we may, to talk about Crossrail in town areas.
Thanks very much. The plenary session to start with was very much a big picture, talking about environmental impact assessments and planning on a sort of grand scale. So I'm looking at the reality of actually what happens when the thing starts to get built, and the way it impacts upon people living around about the site. Just a bit of, I don't know whether people know Whitechapel Station, but it's an amazingly congested station. It's got, you couldn't think of a place with any more steps and changes in level in the station than at Whitechapel. And as Gareth has said, it's surrounded on all sides by residential properties. The station, this is looking west towards the city, as you'd probably gather. And it's at a lower level. There's also the London Underground, which runs in the other direction underneath it. And so what the objective of the new station is to join those two stations with the Crossrail station as well, taking into account all these surroundings. Just to refer to a couple of buildings, that's a place called Trinity Hall, which I shall refer to in a minute. That's Kempton Court, a 1970s block of housing with deep foundations. And this is Whitechapel High Road, is on this side. Just by a bit of background about myself, I've been employed by Tower Hamlets Council since 2004. So I've seen the reality of starting with the petitioning process and public consultation on the original scheme, what was said in Parliament, and then the way the scheme is developed and changed over time, as Gareth has said, and designed the station changed completely. As I said in the last bullet point there. From what we started with, and so the impacts in the environmental impacts statement were nothing like the impacts in reality, so as it was like having a new scheme prompt on in front of you after it had been through the parliamentary process. The reason the council accepted it was because we reckon it's a better scheme. It was better in design terms and better in terms of meeting the objectives of being an accessible station. But that's the constraints that were being faced. Again, some idea of the complexity of the linkages to what's going on there. So that's the Crossrail running lines. The blue bits are the station tunnels, where the actual platforms will be. This is the work sites in Crosshatches, so you can see the number of work sites there are in all the different directions. We have a place called Albion Yard, which sits on top of the tunnels over here. Well, thing I shouldn't do, which I'll talk about a bit. Kempton Court is there, so you can see it sits over the top of the station running tunnels. Trinity Court is down on this side. We have Whitechapel Sports Centre here. We have Swanage School there, Whitechapel Road there. So there's also, I refer to Sainsbury's store, which is there. So all these things are surrounding the work site on the station. So not only were those sites affected by the construction work itself, but in some cases the Crossrail CPO took parts of their land. So part of the school site was taken, part of the Albion Yards car park was taken, part of Kempton Court's car park was taken as well, and part of the Sports Centre's car park was taken as well. So there's also physical impacts as well as construction impacts that were taking place. And there's a summary of some of the impacts and constraints on the site itself. And there the acquisition that had to take place. And the last point is quite important, is that you would have thought with the amount of publicity it was for Crossrail that someone like St. Andrews might have noticed it was happening on the doorstep. But they didn't. They didn't petition at all. And then I think when Crossrail came along and said, we're taking possession of your car park, they expressed surprise at this fact. They told the council they couldn't possibly operate without car park. So the council's forced into a situation of actually having to agree to a multi-storey car park to provide car parking before the Crossrail works could start. But it's you would have thought that, despite the engagement, that people would actually notice what's going on. But also, similarly, the residents of Albion Yard and Trinity Hill also didn't petition. And apparently had no knowledge of what was going on, despite there having been sent a lot of letters by Crossrail, I'm sure. And then the actual complexity of the construction itself. When six contractors working there at one point, one can imagine the confusion that gave rise to in terms of actually dealing with impacts and dealing with communications. So the approach that was adopted by the council and Crossrail was to do a number of things by those bullet points. Well, I'd already been appointed as part of the council's reaction to it, but we set up fortnightly meetings with Crossrail just to actually monitor what was going on. There were community liaison panels for the whole borough, but also we set up sub-panels specifically for two of the actual affected sites. That was the Albion Yard site, which sat on top of the running tunnels, and also Kempton Court likewise. And those meetings take place maybe on a monthly basis. And the point I made in the plenary session, they're chaired by myself, or a council officer. So the council's playing a big role in terms of acting as the interface between Crossrail and the local community. And sometimes it seems strange to say so, but the local community do think that local government is the people that they trust with respect to Crossrail. They're the ones that they feel represents their interests, which is quite important. That's the Sainsbury's car park that was being built, which we were, if you like, press ganging into agreeing to see it happen. But that had to be built before Crossrail could get on the site and start doing the work. One of the key issues and the key impacts was noise and vibration. And there were two problems about Albion Yard itself, which was a listed building. The first thing, if you're putting in secondary glazing into a listed building, you need listed building consent. And the council listed building officer is obviously quite concerned to make sure that the secondary glazing fits in with the character of the building and so on. So that prolongs the process. It takes much longer than one thinks it does. One can talk glibly about the importance of noise insulation in mitigating noise, but my view is that the county has never taken out as to how long it actually takes to do that. So we're faced with situations where some of the properties didn't have noise insulation and the contractor wanted to get on site and start doing noisy works. The other major problem was to do with the sprayed concrete lining, which is the way that the station tunnels were constructed. This is literally what it says, sprayed concrete, but it also involves a lot of breaking out as the sprayed concrete advances. I'm not an engineer, people around here may know better than I what it involves, but it involves, one has to concrete the face as one works along, concrete the ceiling and the floor, and then to move forward one has to break out the concrete face so that there's a breakout takes place every 24 hours or so, and that caused amazingly bad impacts in terms of vibration, particularly in Albion Yard. Albion Yard is a 19th century building, no foundations, with basements, and the vibration impacts seem to reverberate around the building and cause tremendous amount of disturbance at night, the residents couldn't sleep and so on. And Crossrail's showed great flexibility in terms of providing short-term hotel accommodation. That wasn't part of the Crossrail Act, but it was an acceptance that something needs to be done to actually mitigate those sorts of impacts. The other way of mitigating impacts is, of course, on the engineering side itself, and adopting methods which reduce impacts and are quieter, doing it different times of the day. And they're just some examples of how the contractors worked with Crossrail and ourselves, looking at better ways of doing things, smarter ways of doing things that have so much impact. And that process is still going on. Had some complaints from Melbourne Yard recently about one of the shafts at Cambridge Heath, which was related to the fixing of the steelwork. And although the actual noise levels didn't generate, didn't cause problems in terms of the Section 61s from the environmental health side, the fact if you drop a bit of steel in the middle of the night on the ground, it makes a big impact and wakes you up. And so it was dealing with things like that, things that people don't think about when they're going on. And how do you avoid those sorts of isolated incidents going on which can wake someone up and destroy their sleep? So there was, again, positive input from the contractors to try and mitigate impacts. The other sorts of impacts were in terms of, I suppose you might say, sort of land-based compensation. In some cases, the compulsory purchase didn't cover the land that was required to build the schemes, especially bearing in mind the scheme had changed. And so these are some examples that were agreed with Crossrail that they would, or the contractor would undertake to actually reduce some of the impacts in terms of usability of the buildings. These are some more examples of the sorts of things that are done. Swanage School, which is a recently built structure, because of the Crossrail running tunnels running underneath it, there was concerns about settlement in the school. We've got a large glass atrium. It's a really good idea if that's not a crack and fall on the student's head. So that had to be underpinned at the same time, minimising the chance of the atrium collapsing on people as they're using it. So the glass in there was replaced by polycarbonate. And a lot of work took place outside school times, both to avoid interfering with students, avoid exams and so on. Then construction traffic as well. The construction route was along a road called Durwood Street, and it would involve traffic going along there from one end of Whitechapel to the other end of Whitechapel, which we thought was both dangerous, especially as we went past the school. So again, a modification to the lorry route, which was in the Act, working with contractors to get a much more satisfactory arrangement and a safer arrangement. There was a bit of discussion early on about utilities, and of course Crossrail, that's been the saga for all boroughs really. Thames Water mainly, I guess, has decided they need to replace all the utilities that the tunnels go underneath. Whether that's right or wrong is leave it to engineers to say, but in practice the amount of settlement across that has been very, very small. But that caused major chaos. Balance Road, which is a problem all south, we had to be shut for 6 months for gas main and water replacement. We're talking about big bits of kit. The Cambridge Heath water mains are 24 inch, I think, 36 inch water mains, enormous pieces of kit. Caused immense disruption in the area. And again, had to be a lot of flexibility on everyone's part to try and sort that sort of thing out. So, in terms of what have we learned from this? Flexibility and an acceptance that things are going to change, that things won't be as they started with, and then the council and Crossrail and the contractor have to have mechanisms in place to actually make sure they can adapt quickly to things that change. And so then I think the key lessons. The first one is perhaps obvious: expect the unexpected. Communication, we heard about that this morning, which is absolutely fundamental. Once people understand what's going on, they're much more likely to be responsive and supportive. And the third one, which I alluded to as well, is that a single point of contact, that someone that can represent the local authority, but also represent the local authority from the point of view of the contractor and Crossrail, and that person can make decisions reasonably quickly, and also act as the interface with the public. That is it. Thank you very much.